Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
It wasn't a realistic debate. How could you say we absolutely positively have to cut libraries when you have $1 billion sitting in reserves in the TIF funds?
Coming up, we'll hear from a Chicago journalist about Chicago's controversial tax increment financing, or TIF program.
This idea of our being trapped in this moment, this long, long moment of always being caught off guard, I think applies both to nuclear disaster through the deployment of weapons and through nuclear disaster through nuclear power plants.
And we'll hear a recent Chicago presentation commemorating the anniversary of the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. But first, here are some headlines from the Worldwide Indie Media Network with Mitchell Szczepańczyk.
London Indie Media featured pictures and a report from a counter-Olympics demonstration held in East London on July 28, 2012. Quoting from the feature, nearly 1,000 people representing a smorgasbord of campaign groups marched together under the banner of the Counter-Olympic Network. The march was followed by speeches in Wennington Green. As people assembled on the slopes of Mile End Park, they were joined by an intrusion of police liaison officers, disarmingly chatting and joking with the more gullible members of the crowd, while carrying out their usual agenda of surveillance and intelligence gathering. Meanwhile, a samba band tuned up, people made homemade banners, and friendly connections were made between the myriad campaign groups representing that day. The event also featured a counter-Olympics torch rally, passing a torch to representatives from Sochi, Russia, home of the 2014 Winter Olympics, from the campaign NoSochi2014.com, who described the plight of the Circassian people exiled from their lands by genocide and erased from history by the Russians. Austin Indie Media featured the launch of a new police accountability project for Austin, Texas, in the wake of a successful pushback to a police assault. The project, called the Peaceful Streets Project, was founded after an incident on New Year's Day 2012 at an Austin 7-Eleven in which two police officers harassed and assaulted an unidentified woman. A bystander on the scene, Anthony Bueller, began to use his cell phone to record the assault when those two same officers turned their attention on Bueller himself, forced him to the ground, and forced him to take a breathalyzer test, which returned a score of 0.00. Bueller would face felony charges for harassment of a public servant, which he would evade when three other witnesses produced video of the incident clearing Bueller. But Bueller began to hear of other stories of police harassment and joined with other victims of police violence to form the Peaceful Streets Project, which launched the Peaceful Streets Summit, an all-day event on July 14, 2012, of education and inspiring stories, which also distributed 100 video cameras to attendees. Indie Bay featured efforts by activists in Oakland, California to reopen a shuttered library. Quoting from the feature, the historic building at 1449 Miller Avenue was unveiled on the morning of August 13th as the Victor Martinez Community Library, renamed for a recently deceased author who overcame a life of hard agricultural work to become a successful writer and novelist. The building was one of seven branch casualties of budget cuts in the late 70s. On its first day reopened, as garbage was cleared from the grounds and the building was cleaned, donations of books poured in and area children helped to start a community garden in a side lot. In less than 15 hours after its grand opening, however, Oakland police and the city administrator's office deemed the occupation illegal and promptly raided the community library. During the raid, city workers and more than 30 police officers boarded up the entrance and sealed the fence, leaving activists and onlookers with piles of books, food, and cleaning supplies. The next morning, activists reopened the library on the sidewalk in front of the building. It has been growing ever since and includes a garden created by neighborhood children. New Orleans Indie Media featured a list of grassroots actions and events surrounding the 2012 Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida, for the week of August 27th through the 30th. In Tampa, a Food Not Bombs World Gathering precedes the convention. Food Not Bombs chapters will be convening in preparation to feed the thousands of expected protesters coming for the convention, but will also be hosting workshops, skill shares, concerts, and actions, including an action against weapons manufacturer Raytheon. Actions during the convention itself include a march on the RNC, an anti-poverty march for our lives, a roving radical dance party, and a really, really free market. Earth First has also put out a call for eco-actions during the Republican National Convention to highlight environmental destruction and devastation. A full list of all scheduled events is available online on the website resistrnc.org.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the $1 million man always gets his way. Cost a little, some might cost a lot, but I'm the $1 million man, and you will be bought.
Chicago's Tax Increment Financing Program, or TIFS, was introduced as a city development measure during the Harold Washington administration in the 1980s. But in recent years, it has been transformed into a campaign to redirect funds away from ordinary Chicago taxpayers and into unaccountable coffers of a shadow budget controlled by the mayor. It sounds too shady to be true, but research and documentation has been made by those who have been called TIF nerds, as well as by one of the leading authorities of Chicago TIFs, journalist Ben Jarofsky, a freelance writer for the Chicago Reader. Ben Jarofsky recently spoke about TIFs in the city of Chicago at the College of Complex's Free Speech Forum on Saturday, August 4, 2012. Ben Jarofsky's remarks were followed by a question and answer session.
My name is Ben Jarofsky, and I'm a writer for the Reader newspaper here in Chicago. Thank you. I believe this is the second time I've addressed this group on the subject of TIFs. I believe this is the third time I've discussed TIFs in this very restaurant, not including just occasional lunches or breakfasts here where I tend to rant on the subject. I was here for a group of, I believe they were libertarian free market types. And we were in this room, and they were sort of appreciating what I had to say from a different perspective, the taxation issue, which, of course, was probably what sparked my interest in TIFs in the first place. So anyway, what I'm about to say will probably be a repeat of what I said the last time, both to your group and to the libertarians, and what I tend to say whenever I talk about TIFs, which is all the time. I've sort of become known for a program that I have nothing to do with and would like to see blow up. So I know how you do things here, and I prefer to get right to the questions as quickly as possible. So I'll just give a really brief overview, which I scribbled when I was sitting back there listening to the announcements. And I'll start with just a very brief explanation of what TIFFs are. Very brief. So brief that I'm sure during the questions I'll get asked the inevitable question of how they work. But anyway, a TIFF, Tax Increment Financing, is essentially an economic development program in which property taxes are diverted from the taxing bodies that consume them, like the schools and the parks, etc., to fund projects that presumably, and this is in the abstract, this is the way the program is supposed to work, that presumably would not be funded but for the TIFFs, that the projects are so risky in neighborhoods that are low-income neighborhoods where few projects have taken root, that you need some sort of subsidy or assistance to get a developer to go there. So that's the first presumption, that but for that TIFF, but for that subsidy, there would be no development. The second assumption, and this sort of gets at the woman who talked about the Albany Park Library, is that the investment that all these taxing bodies are making by allowing this developer to get the money that would ordinarily go to them, in other words, would ordinarily go to the schools, will then finance development that will bring in more property tax dollars in the future. So it's essentially an investment. The schools are making this judgment, presumably, this is what they're supposed to be doing. They're saying, we are willing to give up $1 million now to fund this project that wouldn't ordinarily be funded, with the idea that in 20 years, that property will be bringing in twice as much money. So it'll be a shrewd investment that will pay off for us. So those are the two presumptions embedded in the whole abstract notion of how TIFFs are supposed to work. Of course, the program doesn't work that way at all. In no way. It's a complete mutation of that abstract. And so, to me, TIFFs have come to sort of symbolize pretty much like everything that's wrong with the way our local government works. The program is built on a lie. They tell us it's not a new tax when, of course, it is. They tell us it's intended for the poorest of poor neighborhoods that, but for that TIFF financing, would not get any projects, when the lion's share of the money goes to some of the wealthiest neighborhoods where projects are being developed all the time without any subsidy. They say it's overseen by independent boards and watchdogs who are free of any kind of political restrictions and are only looking out for what's in the best interest of the citizenry, when, of course, it's overseen by a series of rubber stamp boards filled by people who are put there by the mayor, who knows that they'll do whatever he says. So there is no independent oversight whatsoever at any point, anywhere in the program. They say it's going to help schools and parks, when in fact it diverts millions of dollars away from schools and parks. Doesn't really help them at all. And then there's what I call sort of like the ripple effects of the program that impact sort of the way we view government. To conceal the program, they essentially lied to us on our property tax bills and tell us that it doesn't take money, when in fact it does. So if you look at your property tax bill and you live in a TIFF district, it'll say zero, when in fact, of course, who knows, it takes much more than zero, obviously. In some cases, it takes up to 90% of it or 100% of a tax bill. It has an impact on all the other budget issues that we face, distorting our notion of how these things are happening or what's going on. For instance, last year, the city of Chicago claimed a budget deficit, I believe, don't quote me, I think it was $600 million is what they were saying, something there. And as a result, they had no choice but to cut back the libraries. They were going to cut Monday service. They were going to not going to bring back the pages that they had already fired so that books couldn't be put away. And it was incumbent upon librarians who were supposed to be there to help you find books and materials to put the books away. They said they couldn't do anything about it because we had a $600 million deficit. Well, what they didn't tell us was there's like about $1 billion in TIFF reserves sitting in banks. So because it's a shadow budget, because it's not part of the official budget process, because they tell us it's not even a tax, it's not even on our tax bill, it completely distorted our debate. There wasn't a realistic debate. How could you say we absolutely, positively have to cut libraries when you have $1 billion sitting in reserves in the TIF funds? Similarly with the Chicago Public Schools. I forget where we are right now. It seems to waver from one month to the next on what the deficit is. I believe it last was $700 million. Again, don't quote me on that. I can't keep all my millions together. Same situation. How could we be saying we have to, or they were saying, keep the teachers from getting that last year, the 4% raise, have no money for the extra time that the mayor wants the teachers to spend, no money to hire new teachers or have art. There's no art or music in the school system of Chicago, no drama. So how could you say we can't afford these things when you have these hundreds of millions of dollars sitting in reserve? We've distorted the whole process, the whole budget process. We can't have a real honest discussion because we really don't know how much money is available because there's so much money just sitting in reserve off budget. The final point that I want to make about TIFs and would have been, trust me, I do not want to see this video, but this video was put out by the city of Chicago. I believe it's called What is a TIF? And of course, it's a complete and utter distortion of what TIFs are, how they work, what they do, how they're funded, what they go to fund. And it's sort of like La La Land, bears absolutely no relationship to anything that goes on in the city of Chicago, particularly how they run their TIF program. But essentially, it's our government's notion of about what you, the citizenry, can take. You're not that bright. You're easily confused. You don't really want to understand it. Your eyes are glazing over just by the discussion of it. So we're just going to lie about it. And you'll be happy because you're just essentially a happy people and not a very bright people. On my worst days, I actually share that opinion about the Chicago citizenry.
And you're right.
I'm sorry if I offended anybody. Nobody in this room, of course. So anyway, the whole program has come to me to sort of symbolize sort of the general helplessness of the Chicagoan, the Chicago voter, who just sort of wandering through life in a daze, confused by what's going on and always bewildered. It reminds me of the conversations I heard people have in the 70s when we imposed the lottery, and people would say to me, or they would say to each other, why are the schools so broke? I thought the lottery was going to save that. Of course, it was just money was being shuffled from one fund to the next, wasn't going to education. So anyway, that's sort of my 101 on TIFs. Hate to be so bleak and gloomy. I would try to make a TIF joke, but I can't really think of one. At the moment, this being Saturday night, maybe it was a Thursday night, I'd come up with a TIF joke. Anyway, that's how I see it, so I'll take your questions.
You mentioned that there was $1 billion. You mentioned that there was $1 billion in sort of these shadow accounts.
Yes, sir.
How does daily selling off the parking meter and getting that increase, did any of that money go into this $1 billion? Is that $1 billion separate from that?
Yes, it's completely separate. That's the problem with Chicago finances. There's all these different accounts. But you shouldn't, the TIF program is completely independent from the parking meter program, where they sold the parking meters and put that money again that was supposed to last forever. Forever didn't last very long. So they're two separate things. So again, I'm saying rough $1 billion. I don't know exact number. I saw it in the paper actually just recently in the Sun-Times, but it's roughly $1 billion in reserve TIF money, which they have not spent yet. So it's just sitting there. So in some ways, you could say it's a really brilliant program. It's like a rainy day program. I mean, if you really want, I actually made this argument once, trying to look on the bright side of TIFs. I will now argue for TIFs. I'll do both. Okay, I'll be there. Anyway, so you could say that, but I don't know what they're using the money. Originally, I was absolutely convinced that Mayor Daley was going to use the money for the Olympics, and the Olympics didn't come here, thank goodness. So I don't know what the intention They'll find a way to spend it, but I don't know. They haven't played that card yet. Yes, sir.
I'm a city retiree. I got a small pension from the city, and the mayor says that in this era of high inflation, the city cannot afford to continue to pay a cost of living increase for their retirees. And believe me, we're not getting generous retirements. How can this be true if he's got $1 billion in TIF money? Couldn't he just take some of that and pay the pension plans?
The answer is no. Well, the first part of your question was underscoring what I was saying, that you can't really have an honest discussion about the city's finances when you have this shadow program siphoning off money. It's not accounted for in any budget. It's not accounted for in the city's budget. It's not even in your tax bill. But as the people in Albany Park are learning, people who are fighting that library, the complexity of the TIF program prevents the city from simply just taking the $1 billion and putting it toward paying off the pension obligation, or taking the $1 billion and doing a massive rebuilding of the public libraries, for instance, if they wanted to spend $1 billion. I know that's like so far-fetched to imagine suddenly Mayor Rahm saying, I want to spend $1 billion on libraries. But there's a sort of procedure that must be followed. Since the money is a diversion from the schools and the parks and the other taxing bodies, if you are to raid some of those reserves, you have to give it back proportionally to the taxing bodies, who, at the same rate that you took it from them. So roughly 50% of it goes to the schools. So if you were going to raid that $1 billion reserve, right off the bat, $500 million would go to the public schools. So it wouldn't be available. Right. When you pay your... No. Not pension obligation. When you pay a property... How many people here have ever seen a property tax bill?
We're going to show you one now. We're going to do that.
Okay.
But keep answering questions.
Well, a property tax bill, when you get that second installment, which comes in, well, just came a couple of weeks ago, it itemizes how much you supposedly, allegedly pay. It's all a lie because it doesn't have the TIFs in there. But if you take a look at it, you'll see that roughly 51 or 50% goes to the Board of Education. So if you pay $1,000, then $500 goes to the board. And I think it's 20% goes to the city and down the line to the libraries and the parks, the county, etc. So if the city were to raid the TIF fund, they would have to give back the money. They would have to disperse the money to the taxing bodies at the same rate that they paid in, at the same percentage they paid in. The schools would get 50, the city would get 20, and the libraries would get 6. So that's why you can't just use it for one lump sum idea like the city pensions.
Mike Weiner. No, I'm sorry. You've had your question.
Okay. It seems whenever City Hall announces a new subsidy to attract a business here or keep a business supposedly from leaving the city, that they link it with an announcement of TIF money for a particular use. And it's almost like they want us to think that an employer is paying less taxes than they should be paying, that somehow results in money that's available for other things. You don't see any clarity in that in the Chicago Tribune coverage, the Sun-Times coverage, the local broadcast media.
Does this end with a question mark?
Why isn't there clarity in that? And also, I'm in Occupy Chicago, and I was a point person in the library thing about undoing the cuts in library services.
We have a rebuttal period later on. So.
Oh, okay. Then if you could talk about the absence of clarity in the mainstream media on what this thing is.
What's the question?
Well, I have enough trouble explaining what I do. You're now asking me to try to explain what the Chicago Tribune does. So, I read the Chicago Tribune. It's one of my obligations. And I'm usually bellowing at my wife or dog about this unbelievable editorial that they wrote that, bears no relation to reality. So I do not know why the Chicago Tribune and the Sun-Times cover TIFFs the way they do. I do know that the Tribune is in a very odd position right now. They won't even mention the word. I find this really bizarre. Instead of saying TIFFs, tax increment financing, they'll say the money's coming out of a special economic development fund a special taxing district that's supposed to fund economic development. What are you trying to keep the public stupid? I mean, who even knows what that means? Number one, you know, you should be very specific. You should say it comes out of the TIF program, which is a very controversial program, you know, where it's a tax hike in which money is diverted into these funds, which the mayor controls. That's exactly what it is. So I don't know the answer to your question, and I feel always a little reluctant to try to explain why the Tribune does what it does. So.
That was Ben Jarofsky of the Chicago Reader, whose archive of articles about Chicago TIFFs are online at chicagoreader.com/TIFFarchive. The full audio of the question and answer session at the College of Complexes, which ran more than an hour, is online at Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. On Sunday, August 5th, in memory of the 67th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima in Nagasaki, Japan, a special program titled From Hiroshima to Fukushima took place at the Unitarian Church in Evanston, Illinois. Dr. Norma Field of the University of Chicago, who teaches a class on the subject in the Japanese Studies Department, spoke about how a country that was so devastated by a nuclear explosion could have also become the site of devastation by its own nuclear power industry.
I suppose I should say a word about why I'm here, what got me involved in the atomic bomb issues. I was born and raised in Tokyo. I was born in 1947 of an American father who went to Japan as part of the U.S. occupation after the war, met and married my Japanese mother. Now, everyone here has an earliest memory. You know, it could be a smell, the smell of coffee or whatever. My earliest memory that I can consciously invoke is of my parents arguing over breakfast about U.S. atmospheric testing in the Pacific. And my father, of course, was saying, we've got to do it because of those commies. And my mother is saying, it's so dangerous and it exposes so many people to radiation. I imagine this is in the early 50s, 1952 or so. So that's my earliest memory. And then my second connection with this whole issue that brings us together today is of seeing an image. Many of you may have seen it, but the actual site is much less vivid in Hiroshima. I need to backtrack, sorry. The United States censored all information on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, did not allow images to be circulated for a number of years, certainly throughout the occupation, till 1952. And these images didn't get around. It's only in 1980 that a number of Japanese citizens got to pull their money together to buy 10 feet of film at a time from the U.S. archives. Images circulated before them, but that's the major moment at which moving images come in. But as a 10-year-old or so, with the first TV my family had accessible, I remember seeing a silhouette of a boy sitting on steps, and he had literally been vaporized. And I found that so stunning and horrific that I promised myself then that someday I would teach. And my whole purpose in becoming a teacher would be to keep Japan and the U.S. from going to war again. That was as far as my mind could grasp geopolitics at the time. Now, I have subsequently found teaching a course on the atomic age at the University of Chicago that most young people are simply not horrified by any sort of image anymore, and they have told me so. And it's not completely true, because the minute you add captions, they're suddenly vulnerable, which is an interesting thing to think about. But images, they tell me, cannot horrify them. And there's something to that. And there's also, as a teacher who looks for images with which to horrify people, I know that your own defenses or whatever, your own sensibility gets numbed, and you keep looking for something more and more shocking, which is not a happy condition to be in. So what I want to do today is to start out with a poem, which for me is the thing that always brings me back to that moment, you know, before Hiroshima, before Chernobyl, or now Fukushima, which is where we always are poised. This is a poem written by a woman in 1952, August of 52, so a very early anniversary commemoration, and she had just seen the first photographs that were made available of the impact of the atomic bomb, and she went to her workplace, was shown the picture, and said, "Hey, you compose a poem, because we're going to commemorate this tomorrow." And she had an hour in which to write this poem. And this is the poem which I translated roughly a few days ago. So let me read you that. It's called "Greetings Upon Seeing an Atomic Bomb Photograph." This burnt, raw face of August 6, 1945 belongs to one who was in Hiroshima at the time, one of the 250,000 burnt, raw persons no longer of this world. Still, my friend, let us turn to look each other in the face once again. Faces without a trace of the flames of war. Today's face, radiant with health. Morning's face, fresh. When I search there for the expression tomorrow could bring, a shudder passes through me. The earth holds several hundred nuclear weapons. You walk along the precipice separating life and death. How can you be so serenely beautiful? Listen, can you hear something coming? What needs to be seen is before your eyes. What needs to be chosen is in the palm of your hand. 8:15 a.m. comes around every day. That morning of August 6, 1945, all those 250,000 people who died instantly were, like you, like me, serenely beautiful, caught off guard. That's the end. And more than any actual photograph of dripping flesh or more graphic representations that you can get through animation, this poem has me in its grip still. And it is something that hasn't loosened at all with the internet age. It seems to me that we are always at that moment where we could be caught off guard. And we never believe that this is something, that this catastrophe is something that could come to us. So this image, this idea of our being trapped in this moment, this long, long moment of always being caught off guard, I think applies both to nuclear disaster through the deployment of weapons, and through nuclear disaster through nuclear power plants. And I suppose I should also say that this moment isn't one of safety anyway, because the nuclear power plants in their normal operations are always emitting forms of radiation. I want to, and so for that on the Japan side, and for us who are inhabitants of Illinois, many of us, I suppose. There's also the signal connection we have that the first sustained nuclear chain reaction
took place on the campus of the University of Chicago, it had occurred to me to be a little curious about why you would be playing around with something like this in the middle of a university campus, in the middle of a city. And it turns out that there was a strike going on at Argonne, and that's why it had to be moved from Cook County Forest Preserve, this first daunting experiment, to the campus of the University of Chicago, and that's why we have Henry Moore's sculpture commemorating that spot, that signal achievement of humanity, plunging us towards total destruction. And the remnants are now in Cook County Forest Preserve, so I recommend that you can find information through Wikipedia. So you might want to take a Sunday stroll sometime through Cook County Forest Preserve and find the two sites where the remnants of the first reactors are buried, the Chicago Pile, as it came to be known. But I want to focus not on that physical side of this age, of this early part of our nuclear age, but something else, that we should all be mindful that there were second thoughts about this almost from the very beginning. And what I'm referring to is the July 17th petition of the Manhattan scientists. How many of you know about this? Yeah? Bunch of you. Yeah, good. I'm glad to see that. This is a petition addressed to the President of the United States, that is to say, President Truman. And do you also know that Truman's grandson, Clinton Truman Daniel, a journalist, 55 years old, is in Hiroshima right now? Has any of you read about that? It's very interesting to think that his grandson is there at this very charged moment. In any case, it is the Manhattan scientists, a large number of them, really mobilized by the Hungarian Leo Szilard, who was very key to the physics that went to developing the bomb, who was running around frantic to get his message to Truman. He got Einstein to cooperate with him, and he had this petition, the July 17th petition, July 17th, 45, so very close, right, to the date. And it reads, the key part of it reads, asking Truman, quote, that you exercise your power as commander-in-chief to rule that the United States should not resort to the use of atomic bombs in this war unless the terms which will be imposed upon Japan have been made public in detail, and Japan, knowing these terms, has refused to surrender. But there's a second following upon that, even so, that in such an event, the question whether or not to use atomic bombs be decided by you in the light of the consideration presented in this petition, as well as, and this is key, all other moral responsibilities which are involved. So this is July 17th, 1945. A number of times when I take up this material in courses, students will say, but they didn't know what it really involved. Well, they knew well enough, these scientists, well enough that they were trying to get the President of the United States not to use this newfound, wonderful gadget. This petition was signed by 71 scientists at the Manhattan Project's Metallurgical Laboratory, aka Met Lab, at the University of Chicago. The mission of that lab was to produce the plutonium for atomic bombs. It was signed by 67 scientists at the Oak Ridge facility in Tennessee, where uranium-235 was separated from 238 to prepare the uranium core for the Hiroshima bomb. 18 at Oak Ridge wanted to modify the end, interestingly, to say that responsibility for use of atomic bombs is shared with our allies. They wanted shared responsibility written in, but they signed the petition. And only two Oak Ridge scientists signed a counterposition petition saying that the Szilard petition was a security risk. And, quote, this is the common alpha and omega that I have encountered in the discussion of the atomic bombs. If we can save even a handful of American lives, then let us use this weapon now, was what the two counter-petition signatories stated. So that is often an issue. It saved American lives, and if we want to really make a strong case, it saved Japanese lives too. An argument based on something that didn't happen, so I don't know how we can make such a strong case. And in any case, whatever the limits of knowledge on the part of the president and others then, we have no excuse to plead ignorance now. I want to briefly address, and I'm going fast. I hope not too fast, because I really want to save time for Mr. Yamada and a lot of time for Q&A. But I want to touch on the question that, or the comment that so many people make after March 11th, 2011. Like, why did it have to happen in Japan of all places? Isn't that ironic? And the answer is yes, and at the same time, overwhelmingly no, that it made complete sense that it should happen in Japan, or it could have happened in France, or it could have happened here in Illinois, the most nuclear state in the Union. But it's not, if it's ironic, it's in this sense. First of all, Japanese as well as German scientists were very much involved in developing a nuclear weapon in the late 30s and 1940s. And it's the dual promise that has really been, what to call it, Aladdin's lamp, the sorcerer's apprentice, this dual nature, that the promise of unlimited energy on the one hand and the promise of the capacity to destroy your enemy and, by the way, yourself. And it seems that we have, in the 60-some, close to 70 nuclear years, always played one against, off against the other. So now you see the destructive side, now you don't, and somehow you keep making excuses. It was very helpful for me to hear David Boris talk about arguments presented about, or wariness about taking on the nuclear power issue here. But so there was that imperative in Japan anyway, and also something that often comes up, well, scientists can't be stopped in their quest for knowledge, right? And scientific progress is something so special that no one should get in the way. So there was that to begin with. And then secondly, yes, that devilish phrase, atoms for peace. It's ironic that Eisenhower, of course, as a military commander, thought that the atomic bombs had not been needed. He had a different emphasis once he became president. He saw that once we're in the nuclear age, people use whatever tools they have at hand, so they're going to use nuclear weapons. Nuclear warfare will be was on the verge of becoming normalized in his view, which alarmed saner heads, as there were back then. And then Eisenhower in France and Britain. And Eisenhower thought, I just don't want to be always being attacked for promoting nuclear war. Hence the Atoms for Peace program, whereby nuclear technology, civilian technology, would be proffered our allies. By the way, in Eisenhower's term, we went from 1,000 nuclear warheads to 22,000. That is under the regime of the man who announced Atoms for Peace. So keep that in mind whenever you hear Atoms for Peace. And moreover, you know about how we're excited about, hot and bothered about Iran these days. And of course, Iran, Pakistan, they got their first nuclear reactors under this program. So as usual, we are right in it at the beginning. There was something astonishing. How many of you know have ever heard of the Stockholm Appeal, 1950? Anybody? Yeah. Huge. I mean, extraordinary campaign. Even if you say the people in the Soviet orbit were all voting, that still doesn't cancel it. 1950 Stockholm Appeal that called for the absolute banning of nuclear weapons. 273.5 million signatories worldwide. Remember, this is before Facebook. 6.4 million in Japan and 3 million in the United States. It comes to coincide with the Red Purge in Japan. It becomes an important part of it, whereby the U.S. priorities switched from making sure that Japan was free of its militarist runaway quasi-fascist leadership to making sure that Japan was a useful ally in our geopolitical programs, i.e. let's make it possible to rearm Japan and so forth and so on. It's kind of swapping prisoners in jail, you know, from the prime ministers, the Class A war criminals, to labor union activists who walked from door to door circulating the petition for the Stockholm Appeal. Unfortunately for the United States, the Atoms for Peace was announced in December 53, March of 1954, with the insouciance of military folk in the castle Castle Dragon, is that what it was? In the Bravo shot over Bikini, the United States explosion was many times more powerful than planned and irradiated a Japanese tuna vessel along with many other people in the area. And that generated a campaign, anti-nuclear campaign, by housewives, is the language normally used in Tokyo. And again, before Facebook and Twitter, 32 million signatures in 54. This is also when Godzilla develops and so forth and so on. The U.S. and the proponents in Japan who wanted Japan to get nuclear technology, and for the leadership, I am very certain this had to do with being tacitly a nuclear power, not nuclear energy only, but nuclear power. And Americans... many on the American side came up with reasoning of because of Hiroshima, this is the part that's not ironic, because of Hiroshima, therefore we owe this. As Christians, in order to make up for what we did in Hiroshima, we owe them this new technology. So there was that kind of reasoning and a huge PR campaign. The Japanese people were quickly gotten over what was called their nuclear allergy. And that is how we have the nuclear village. We have kind of seemingly completely blinkered and deaf responses on the part of the Japanese government to restarting nuclear energy, the power plants. And it is, again, that I think the dual purpose of an energy source and being a latent nuclear power that keeps the 1% in Japan absolutely determined to stay on course. Now, I want to touch a little bit on the social consequences of the disaster in Fukushima, because Mr. Yamada can tell us very expertly about what the material, the technological consequences are and the terrible pickle we're all in. And to do so, I'd like to quote Ms. Muto. She sort of appeared from nowhere and became a national heroine at one of the first large demonstrations on September 19th last year. She comes from Fukushima. She has been an anti-nuclear activist since Chernobyl, which is, she said, after Chernobyl, I started studying about nuclear power. And her reason for her, the first reason she will give you for becoming an anti-nuclear activist is she says, I do not want to live off energy that necessarily requires radioactive exposure on the part of other human beings. And she's talking about the whole process from uranium mining, often by indigenous peoples, whether in the United States or Australia. She doesn't want to be dependent on that, on the people who work in nuclear power plants, on the people who transport spent fuel. So I have to somehow figure out a different way to live. And she pretty much was managing to live off the grid and using natural things in her environment to have a cafe, which, of course, she's been wiped out of her means of livelihood. You can find a lot of that, including spectacular slides of her pre-March 11th life, as well as her... did I leave off my own website? I may have. I didn't. In the middle of your resource sheet, there's something called the Atomic Age, and this is a site I'm maintaining with colleagues. It's a University of Chicago site, which is, again, ironic, right? University of Chicago and its role in nuclear power. You can find a great deal of that information, so please click on that somewhere. But Ms. Muto, in her speech, her theme is, we have been divided. I think of her as a very astute activist, too, because she is always warning people, don't set up false enemies. You know, the people who are arguing with you right now about this are not the real enemy, probably. And this is what she said about how we in Fukushima were divided early on. So, quote, caught between the campaign launched ever so quickly to proclaim our safety on the one hand and our own uncertainty on the other, the ties holding us together have been sundered. In our neighborhoods, our workplaces, at school and at home, how many of us have suffered and grieved. Like it or not, decisions are pressed upon us every day, to flee or not to flee, to eat or not to eat, to hang out our wash or not to hang out our wash, to make our children wear face masks or not to force them. You can imagine how hard when your kids' schoolmates aren't wearing face masks to persuade them to wear something that nobody else is, to till our fields or not to till them, to protest to someone something or remain silent. All manner of agonizing decisions have confronted us. And this is all overlaid on an increasingly economically stratified society. So you can see that the economic, you know, can you afford to flee or not? Can you afford to buy more expensive, safe food? What can you tell your children? Do you risk social ostracism by complaining to your child's school or daycare authorities that you're worried about their food sources? How can you do that every day? If you're a single mother, how can you have the energy to be informed about what food and water is safe for your child? As Ms. Muto says, people eventually become exhausted and they don't want to learn anymore because they feel helpless. And once you have a nuclear disaster, it's in every pore of your being because you're breathing it, you're drinking it, you're ingesting it through food. Even the places that are not hot spots are also through food circulation and water and air circulation. The whole archipelago, and let us know, we know that the archipelago is not bounded by a magical boundary. The rest of the world is being exposed to the consequences of Fukushima as it was to Chernobyl. So two quick examples of the kinds of things that come up. One is in that region that was within the 20-kilometer range, an ancient, like over 1,000-year festival, ritual of chasing wild horses is being revived at full scale this year. And everyone, at least advertising the site, reporting on it, is very excited. But you have to say, yeah, but who is this good for? Is it good for the horses? Is it good for the tourists it's attracting? Yeah, the tourists bring some money in. Is it good for the riders? Is it good to give the impression that this place is safe? At the same time, as an outsider, what position are you in to criticize something that brings energy and joy to these devastated people? It's a very, very hard place, and there are countless occasions like that. The spreading of debris that's been portrayed as a patriotic act. You're not willing to accept debris from northern Japan. Well, what kind of Japanese are you? Well, if you really care about the well-being of all Japanese people, you keep the debris where it is instead of turning it into a patriotic duty to share in the pain. Don't ruin the whole land. So that kind of problem. Another very interesting article, because usually when we talk about discrimination, and let me tell you that Fukushima makes you get what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in a new way. Discrimination about marriage, for example. Young men in Fukushima seeking women to marry them are having a really hard time. Now, it's curious that it's not women who are being highlighted, because usually when we talk about, you know, worrying about the next generation, it's the women who are condemned. And this is not to say the women aren't in a terrible place, but it's interesting to have the men have the spotlight on them. And I suppose, and they are complaining about discrimination. Well, is it discrimination for those on the young men on the receiving end who can't find young women to marry them through these agencies? Of course it's experienced as discrimination, it is. But for the young women, people, I think we can all of us understand, don't really want to move to Fukushima, right? And this comes back to the government of Japan having so narrowly defined the evacuation zone so as not to have to take financial and other responsibility for evacuating large. So many, 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 many people have remained in Fukushima who should not have. And then you have all these other social ramifications of economic inequities, those who get compensation, those who don't. There you start identifying people to blame who shouldn't be blamed. And now you have men who are feeling bereft of marriage partners unfairly. And it is unfair, but it's not because Japanese women are out to discriminate against them. These are the decisions that you are faced with individually and socially if you have a nuclear disaster befall you. I can't finish, I'm finishing up now, but without having mentioned brought up the cancer issue. The great majority of scientists will say you can't prove a cause and effect relationship between these exposures, even in Chernobyl. And by the way, on the website I pointed out to you, the Atomic Age in Chicago, in the resources, there is a link to this massive Slavic language study. It's Yavlikov, Nestorenko Yavlikov, which Very curiously, the Western language sources, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN, the UN people, and others, for some reason, on the Chernobyl accident, don't seem to have been consulting Slavic language resources, which is weird, right? You'd think that they could think about research done in the language of the region where languages of the region where the disaster took place, but you can link to that, where you find a very different picture of the cost of Chernobyl. But so many people will say, can't, you know, from Fukushima, the results are going to be so negligible, it's not even worth setting up a research design. I've read that too. Well, as Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the founders of Physicians of Social Responsibility, will tell you, you can't say your cancer, my cancer, was caused by this, by Three Mile Island, by the Pacific Islands testing, or this and that. Because, first of all, we live in such a toxic environment anyway, and that these toxins and radiation have a synergistic effect. And I don't know why, who in their sane mind would not want to try to reduce the toxicity of our environment? Why be content to keep adding radiation to that mix? And I suspect that if I were to ask you the question, who in this audience has cancer or has family members or close friends who have wrestled with cancer, I'm suspecting that almost all of your hands would go up. And on the organization that first hosted, the website of the organization first hosting Mr. Yamada, called Fukushima Response, and they're hoping to set up chapters around the country. Dr. Carol Wolman, a psychiatrist who's been very active on peace anti-nuke issues, says there are many things we can do to get, you know, and we have to get over our indifference and our fear. And one of them, she says, is we have to get over the social taboo of bringing up the nuclear power plant issue with our friends and neighbors. And I think about what is that fear about? Part of it is fear, right? Fear of cancer. We're all afraid of cancer, although cancer is by no means the only health problem. There are legion others, cardiovascular illnesses and thyroid problems among them. And maybe some of you have heard the expression, the Chernobyl necklace, because so many people have had thyroid problems. There's that fear, and then there's the economic fear. In communities in the United States that store depleted uranium, people don't want people doing research on it because their real estate values will go down. And I think that's also very true for a community siting nuclear power plants. Don't look at the unusual cancer incidences in your community because that plant is safe and it funds excellent schools for us. I think it's impossible to have individual solutions to this, and that's why we have to think about social and government solutions too. We have to pressure the government into being socially responsible so that we can do something about what imperils us all. So I want to say, how many times as a species can we be caught off guard and survive? And that's the message I'd like to leave you with.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Rita Sand for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode From the Trenches.